And good Monday morning to you out there. It's June 19th, and this is Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley, the new co-host of Mountain Money, here in studio with Doug Wells, Larry Warren, our beloved GM, retired. His last day was last Friday, and I'm here trying to fill his shoes.
Well, welcome. It's going to be a great new partnership. I'm going to miss Larry, but I'm looking forward to the next several years with you and I doing the show.
Oh, I like that. Several years. Thanks, Doug. That's great. Today, speaking of great, let's look at the weather. Sunny and clear with a high near 84. It's going to be pretty calm out there. Good day for a bike ride if you get out there before the heat. Tonight, a low around 52 degrees. High of 87. Same for Wednesday. It's looking sunny and warm all week. In Heber, high of 91 today and 93 tomorrow, and then the low 90s and high 80s all week long. And be careful out there, Doug. We've got a heat warning in southern Utah. Triple digits, so make sure you stay hydrated. Make sure you keep kids and pets out of those hot cars, too. Coming up, our first guest, we've got some special guests for you this morning. You know him as Phil Dunphy from Modern Family. We have actor Ty Burrell and his business partner Jeff Barnard here. They're the owners of the eating establishment. We're going to check in with them about what they have planned for the restaurant and the season ahead.
Yeah, no, we're really excited about that show. And we mentioned Larry stepping down, retiring. I know having Ty come on board this show is something he worked on for several years. So thank you to Larry and also Jeff for bringing Ty in the studio for us this morning. Our second guest is going to be Nathan Rafferty. He is the CEO and president of Ski Utah. Some really impressive numbers they've got to share with us about last year's ski season. And then Renee and I are going to be talking about some of the local news, some of the financial news that happened in the last week. So that's going to be the show today. It's going to be a great show. You're going to want to stay tuned. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW.
Gordo here. And I'm Larry with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We provide transportation to the airport, Park City, and Deer Valley, utilizing private black cars, SUVs, and shared ride van service.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summers on the fairway, winters on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money here on KPCW Radio. The time is 9:09. I'm Renee Bodley here with Doug Wells, and we've got some special guests here. We've got Jeff Barnard and Ty Burrell. You guys know Ty Burrell as Phil Dunphy and Modern Family. Welcome, you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Now, you guys are here as owners of the eating establishment. How long have you owned the restaurant now?
Well, we officially took over the restaurant May 1st, 2016.
Last May.
Yeah.
So
it's been a little over a year.
I should mention that we're a percentage of the owners. There's really five main owners: Jeff and I, my brother. It's all very nepotistic / big love.
It is Utah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that, right?
That's
right.
In the
ideal world, you want to do business with your friends and family.
Yes.
if you can make it work.
You know, it's interesting because when we first went into business, I'm sure you heard a lot too, you know, be very careful about going into business with your family. But it really has been until today, when Jeff and I are going to get into a huge fight on air.
Oh, good. Okay. Stay tuned for that.
That makes for good radio.
But it's been an incredible thing because everybody trusts each other. There's the two of us, my brother, Richard Noel, and then the one person who isn't in the family and probably not coincidentally feels like his family, but also is not coincidentally probably the most all around, talented person in the group is Dave Hunt.
Okay, and your brother Duncan is the one that started in the restaurant business, right? Really here in Salt Lake, Bar X was his first restaurant, is that correct?
That was actually the same group. It was the same ownership group. Duncan and Richard have been putting in the legwork from the beginning in terms of the day-to-day operations. We were all in there kind of, scrapping to get Bar X on its feet at the beginning, but really those two took over and ran that and have run Beer Bar And the rest of us, and then now with Eating Establishment, Jeff is actually the person who's there day to day.
Well, in Bar X, in Beer Bar, are really known, they're in Salt Lake City, they're known for having a really nice bar, a really high-end bar. And I know with the Eating Establishment, you left a lot of things the same, but one of the things you changed was the bar. Tell us why you did that and how that's worked out over the last year.
Well, right. Bar X is a craft cocktail bar, and Beer Bar is obviously beer. But one thing the Eating Establishment didn't probably do very well is the bar and the cocktails and the beer and all of that. So we knew we could take a healthy business food-wise and add our bar expertise to it and try to grow the business. So that's really the main reason we...
Yeah, I think we were at a period where we were sort of looking for the next thing, and Jeff is, you know, what are you, a third generation business person in Park City?
Yeah.
Has always kind of been keeping tabs on local businesses, and especially with the way up in Park City, so many businesses were going towards in corporate directions. Jeff was, I'm speaking for you because I'm kind of bragging on you a little bit. But Jeff was really, has been keeping an eye out for a business that we could kind of take the same model that we did with Bar X, which was taking a place that was already established and beloved in some ways, but maybe could use a little bit of love. And so really kind of trying to keep an institution or refurbish an institution. And you can probably speak more to that, but about the situation in Park City with Eating Establishment.
Right. So the Rick Anderson, who was the previous owner of the Eating Establishment and the building, he sold the building. And the new owner had a lease prepared with Vail Resorts to put the Patagonia store in the Eating Establishment space. And so the lease was drawn up but not signed yet. So we were very close to losing the Eating Establishment when I found out about it. And all of us, I mean, I have history going to the Eating Establishment, but everybody in our group also did. And so we decided to see if we could save the business from closing. And I'm really glad we did, because now we have a Patagonia store on Main Street also that's wonderful, and we have the Eating Establishment. So we didn't have to lose an iconic Park City business.
It's nice when it works out that way. Were you guys already looking in Park City for locations, or was it happenstance that you found out about it?
Well, no, actually we were. I spent months looking for a location to put Bar X or Beer Bar on somewhere on Main Street. And the landlord, who's Jim Gaddis, who's a local, he's been up here for decades. I know him, and I found out about it. They knew I was looking, and they asked, do you want to put Bar X or Beer Bar in the Eating Establishment space? And, I mean, I immediately said, no, I want to keep the Eating Establishment going, and was immediately really liked the idea.
And Jeff and Ty, what you guys have done is a nice combo. You have that local flavor still of the Eating Establishment. You've kept a lot of the same menu items. But then you've added that nice bar area with the craft cocktails of Bar X. And one of the things that we talked about in December when I was there for the open house was the history of craft cocktails in the Prohibition area. And so I said, this feels new and hip, and we are doing the Bar X thing. And Ty, I think you said, actually, we're doing what they did way back in Prohibition era when it comes to craft cocktails.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, Duncan and Richard could speak more to this, but there's very little that's pretentious about that stuff, even though it kind of gets a pretentious label. All it really is it's very old-fashioned drink making. There is a version of drink making that's happening now that is, you know, more in the sort of quote-unquote mixology world, where there's, you know, smoke and a you know, a unicorn and but
and
really,
foamed infusions.
Yeah, foamed infusions. It's but it's a little bit like akin to the molecular gastronomy, but for drinks. But these drinks are really just old-fashioned drinks made, we hope, made well, All the ingredients are made from scratch. So it's labor intensive. Excuse me. It's labor intensive in that they take a lot of time before every shift to juice everything fresh, and the ice is, you know, it's meticulous. We hope that it reflects in the quality of the drink. And that was really a big part of what happened in Barracks was really a big part of what happened, I think, in Eating Establishment was, we hoped anyway, it was trying to take something that already had a ton of character. Barracks was making those drinks when it opened. You know, that's what it was. It opened in 1933 when the year Prohibition was repealed. So it really was, it's nothing new. It's just going back to what it was initially. And we hope, to what you were saying before, that it has still that local flavor. We hope that the Eating Establishment still does. We hope that locals go into that space and feel it's the space that they grew up going to, and hopefully, you know, that it feels loved.
You know, it's funny how things go full circle.
You know,
for a while, the American society was, you know, better, faster, cheaper, with a small emphasis, with a small B on, mm-hmm. under better. And you think about, you know, like coffee, you'd go to a coffee shop, frankly, you know, 20 years ago, the coffee wasn't that good.
Yeah.
And what we found is Americans are willing to pay a little bit more for a high quality experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really nice thing that we've seen. And speaking of things going full circle, you mentioned Barracks opened the same year Prohibition ended.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going back to Prohibition here in Utah, but we're getting close, you know, with the new liquor laws. Are you guys fearful about the impact on your business? Obviously, now we have Uber and Lyft, and people should be having a designated driver or having mm-hmm. somebody drive them home. But the reality is it will probably impact businesses like yours.
You know, I didn't want to jump in front of you there. When the news first came out, I was a little bit nervous, and I know that Duncan and Rich are feeling nervous about that. But all the businesses are in the same position. Everybody's going to be in the same boat, and I do think that fleet transportation is the direction of the future. Anyway, I think that, you know, the last 3 years. The percentage of teenagers getting their driver's license is dropping at something around 10% a year. I think that in 5 to 10 years, much fewer young people are going to be getting driver's licenses because it's just more affordable to use a fleet in almost all circumstances. So ultimately, it doesn't really worry me that much. I don't know. What's your feeling?
Well, I kind of... I mean, we don't really know what's going to happen, and there's not a lot we can do about it. I mean, we can try to do some things, but the legislature's in charge, and so we're just going to go forward with our business and do the best we can and hope it all works out. One thing I think people are going to do is stay closer to home if they go out to dinner or drink and just be closer to home instead of traveling as far.
So. Are either one of you planning on doing some lobbying on behalf of the tourism industry? You have three big, high-profile restaurants, and Nate Rafferty, who's going to be in here in a few minutes with Ski Utah. I know he's talked to the governor and to the Speaker of the House and the Senate president about maybe finding some ways to scale back this 0.05. Have you guys been approached by the hospitality industry or the beverage industry to do anything mm-hmm. along those lines?
Richard and Duncan have, and we've joined some organizations that are supporting that type of move. I'm sorry, I don't know the names of them, but we are trying to support those organizations.
Well, switching gears a little bit, you've had the restaurant now for about a year. Anything that has surprised you guys that you thought, whoa, didn't see this coming?
Well, that always happens in business. You always get some surprises. So, when we first took it over, we kept it the same for about 6 or 8 months while we got our plans in line, and then made changes, and we've had really nice business increases as far as the business volume has gone, and lots of compliments from locals and tourists about the business. I've learned a lot, like little things, like I asked the kitchen to change the bacon because I wanted a higher quality bacon. So when we ordered the bacon, it was thicker, but there were fewer slices in the box. So on Sunday afternoon, we ran out of bacon after
oh, no.
I changed the bacon to try to make an improvement, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm learning everyday restaurant things. We know a lot of bar things that we've had experience with, but the restaurant's been a little bit new. But overall, it's been really positive. And most of the people that work there, probably 95% of the people that work there for Rick Anderson that were there. You know, they've all stayed and they all seem really happy. And so I rely on them a lot to help me not screw it up.
You know, there's few businesses out there. Well, first off, just business in general is hard, right? This is a business show. We talk to entrepreneurs all the time. You know, new businesses, probably 80% failure rate. Restaurants are really, really hard. You guys know what you're doing. You have a recipe. You're good operators. You roll it out. You know, another industry, and Ty, I want to talk a little bit about your journey because I think there's some parallels in acting in business. You know, you look at the acting industry, entrepreneurs probably have an 80% likelihood of not succeeding. Mm-hmm. Probably in acting, it's much, much higher than that, the failure rates.
I would kill for a 20% success rate.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? And, you know, we know you as a celebrity, right? America knows you as a celebrity, but your path to get there, it was 2 decades to get there. And I want to talk about the tenacity that it took to stick with it, and just if you would just share with us a little bit about your journey and some of the things you've learned about tenacity. Our high schoolers just got out of school last mm-hmm. week, so there's some kids listening to the show today that maybe are starting their journey. Tell us about what you've learned about tenacity.
Well, my version of tenacity would be not having another skill set.
Their choice.
If you don't have the burden of another skill set, then you don't. At every point at which you feel like you can't handle any more failure, and you look around at the landscape of employment and see that you don't have the ability to do it, you go back in. I'm oversimplifying, but that on a broad scale, that is true. I'd never really found. I was sort of a delusional athlete when I was younger. That was the closest thing I ever found to anything that I felt sort of semi-capable at. So it did simplify my path a little bit. But within that, there's a little bit of a grind too, and I'm sure this is true of every occupation. Constant and sort of regular challenge does put you in a little bit of a different mindset, and you become sort of fit, I think, in a way. It really wasn't a thing where every day, if I had failed at, say, 25 auditions in a row, which happened quite regularly, but it wasn't a thing where you wake up, you know, kind of feeling like you're suffering. It's really, it becomes the just the way you become sort of fit in a way. You just become sort of, that becomes your conditioning. I always drew most inspiration from baseball, oddly. If you watch batters in baseball, their success rate is, you know, you're in the Hall of Fame if you're at 30% success. And watching them grind when things were not feeling good, they're not raking or, you know, hitting the ball well, watching them kind of rely on their technique and sort of grind out at bats. I learned a lot from that. But I suspect that it's not that different from other jobs in that we, even if, it, you know, in acting, it's specific about trying to get a job with every audition. So that success rate is so low. But I suspect that everybody's job is full of, you know, throughout the day, even if you have one job, of feeling moments where you're succeeding and moments that you're not, and you just kind of become accustomed to it.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things we all have to learn is how to deal with rejection.
Yeah.
Right, and in business, it's really important to go out there and keep trying. I read an interview with you where your plan B, if acting didn't work out, was probably to teach drama.
True.
And you had a statement that, you know, the first thing you would tell kids in their first class is the job of acting is not about acting. The job of acting is about auditioning.
Yeah.
And I suspect the challenge with auditioning is the rejection is very personal. Any thoughts on dealing with rejection?
Yeah, that's a thing that I still feel like training programs may not address as well as they should, which is that I'm talking about acting training programs. Join us next week on Niche Conversations by Ty Burrell. But those training programs don't really prepare you completely for the life. The life is auditioning. That's what you do. That is what you do. 90% of the time, there were times when a good year I would work maybe 2 months, and that's a good year, because then the other 10 months you're auditioning. That rejection that you're talking about is the only way that I was ever able to make peace with it, is to work as hard as I could. I think, and I'm sure this is true of every occupation on earth, but sleeping well at night is not leaving something on the table. Mm. And that, for me anyway, personally, it was trying to get every ounce out of every audition that I could. And that I also failed at that at times. It's not like I was 100% at even that. But, if you're, say, I was probably auditioning like 4 or 5 times a week, and most of those were no's. But it's mitigated greatly by a feeling like I did every single thing that I could. And I think I'm sure that's true
Can we stay on this just one more minute? Because I think it's so important. And one of the things I work with my teenage daughters on is, what do you do to get yourself in the right mindset? How do you feed yourself the things that you need to feed your brain to keep yourself in a positive mental attitude? And in your case, it was 2 decades.
I'm not sure what translates from performance to other lines of work, but I always tried to put everything I could into the technical side of what I was doing so that I could be free on the creative side. And that mindset also just was true of just existing day to day in a period when you're failing more than you're succeeding, much more than you're succeeding. Just trying to take care of all of the technical things as well as you can, and freeing your mind up to be yourself and to not be preoccupied. That's true of actual being in performance. The more you, and this is true of athletes and dancers or anybody, the more you've put the time in on the technical side, the freer you're able to be in terms of expressing yourself. But I suspect it's also true of just day-to-day life, that if you're covering all of your bases and doing all of the sort of the stuff you're supposed to do, the more relaxed and free you're able to be.
Well, thanks for being so generous with your thoughts on that. I want the last question on this, and we'll get back to the eating establishment and then wrap up. I want to talk about the flip side of it. So we talked about the struggle of the journey. You know, we've all seen celebrities blow up.
I am right on the edge.
Wait, let me start the recording before that happens.
It's a double-edged sword. Do you think getting your celebrity stardom in your 40s helped you deal with it better than maybe some people that achieved it in their teens?
Yeah, absolutely. I've considered that a real blessing. I was pretty much a lost kid in my 20s. And if I were given the sort of, a lot of the cliches of Hollywood are true about, in terms of not being told no once you're in that door. It's a very strange world, and I think it's not great for human psychology in terms of being told no, 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 and then once you get through that door, never being told no again. In some cases, people do really cater to you, and it takes sort of a mature person, which, you know, my wife would debate whether I'm mature now, but I marvel at the young actors on our show who started when they were 10 and 11, now in their 20s. I think there's a level of restraint that is required when you're in a situation where people do basically will tell you yes. You have to kind of manually restrain yourself. And I don't know if I would have been able to do that. But I watch the young people on our show succeed at that every day, and I marvel at it.
Well, Ty Burrell, thank you. You bring a real gift into the homes of America every night. You know I have a tough day. I come home and I turn on Modern Family on demand, and you get a good laugh. And it really brings a smile to people's faces. And what a great gift you give us every...
Thanks for keeping me employed.
And Jeff Barnard with the Eating Establishment. Anything else you want to add about the restaurant before we leave or doing business in Park City?
Well, I'll say I love coming up here every day. I come up and work Monday through Friday. I try to talk to as many people as I can, locals and tourists. And I love coming up here and being part of the community and getting to know you and other people around the community has been really, really fun. So I thank the community for supporting our business.
Well, we thank you for all the work at the Eating Establishment. Sure. Look forward to seeing more of what you're going to be doing there. And this is... The Mountain Money, that was Jeff Barnard and Ty Burrell with the Eating Establishment. The time is 9:33. We will be right back with Nathan Rafferty from Ski, Utah. Thanks, you guys.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with benefits, from lodging projections, educational videos, group sales leads, and a listing on the top travel site for Park City, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining can be found at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of contemporary and mountain modern home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake and offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. What a special treat that was to have Ty Burrell and Jeff Barnard in. Ty is one of the co-owners of the Eating Establishment, and great conversation with him about not just the restaurant, but just his journey as an actor. Lots of very motivational. As I was doing a little research and learning about his story, I was so excited to have him as a guest.
That was a real treat. And I really like those questions about tenacity and resilience. And that really does apply to everyone in the business world, not just acting.
It does. Can you imagine dealing with rejection 10 out of 12 months out of the year?
Sadly, I don't have to imagine it.
Yeah. All right, we're going to switch gears. We have in studio with us now Nathan Rafferty. He is the CEO and president of Ski Utah. The new numbers just came out. Snowbird just closed 2 weekends ago, and you guys held off your numbers until they closed, but the final numbers are very impressive. Nate, first off, welcome to the show, and share with us, if you would, just the highlight numbers.
Sure. So like you said, Snowbird just finished up. They had so much snow. We all had a ton of snow this year, and we often are giving our numbers in late May, but Snowbird was hanging on, and they were trying to get to Father's Day, warmed up a little bit, didn't quite get there. But, yeah, we announced a second all-time record in a row, 4.584 million skier days, so officially 4,584,658. And that's up about 3% from last year's all-time record and up 8% from our five-year average. So we're kind of hitting on all cylinders, had, tons of great marketing and tons of great snow and a good economy and, kind of have to have all these things lined up to do well.
So, Nathan, we've had you in just about every year to share the numbers. I know that 3% is a good number, but before I did the show and had a chance to chat with your organization every year, 3% seems like, and I think a lot of people in the audience are like, oh, okay, 3%. It's not 10%, right? It's not a huge number. Do you guys have a goal, a target growth number, and how does that compare to how we're doing?
You know, each resort kind of has an individual number, and we put some numbers together and try to think about where we want to be at the end of the year. There's so many variables, and we're really happy with 3%, especially when it's over an all-time record. And you know, anytime we can schedule a press conference in the spring is a good thing. And that means we're going to have an all-time, you know, all-time record. And, no, we feel really good about it.
There are a couple of things that you cannot control when it comes to the success of a ski season. One, obviously, Mother Nature, the amount of snow that we get. Secondly, Nathan, there's an early Thanksgiving and a late Easter that has to play a role in how good these numbers are going to be. And we had those, both of those factors came through for us this year, didn't they?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the stars have to align in so many ways. And the ski industry is so atypical, right? You know, you can have your best marketing and put a ton of money towards that, and if Mother Nature doesn't come through for you, you're just kind of out of luck. And you know, luckily resorts here are so mature, and you know, all have really incredible snowmaking infrastructure, so that helps a ton. But you know, we would have been above that 3% had we gotten a really early start. We had a press conference in mid-November, as we always do, to kick off the ski season, and it was dry as a bone.
Yeah.
So we really we got going a couple weeks late, and then it really warmed up in March too, and so the foot kind of came off the gas there. You know, we need a lot of snow. We don't just need a lot of snow. We need it early. We need it at the right time. And then, you know, in Christmas holiday, it's nice to see the blue sky as well. So, you know, we're really at the whim of Mother Nature.
You know, speaking of Christmas, this coming Christmas is unusual in that the way Christmas falls, there's some schools are going to be off a week earlier and going back a week earlier. Others are here in Park City go right up to the end and then get off later. Is that good for the ski industry, or does that present a challenge?
Well, it kind of cuts both ways. It spreads things out a little bit, so that's not a bad thing. But you know, Christmas is typically such an important period for us. You know, I think we'll do just fine. You know, we look at all those holidays, including Easter as well, and that's one that's really tricky. That can kind of stretch the ski season for us, but if it's too late, then it stretches too far and it's just out of the picture.
Yeah, Easter can fall between March 22nd and April 25th.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty wide area for you guys to market around and cover. You had indicated in your news conference last week that there is room for improvement. Where?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we just think about the busy days, those Saturdays, you're like, where are all these people coming from? And the, you know, in those busy holiday periods. But the entire month of January, with the exception of Martin Luther King Day, is absolutely some room for improvement there. You know, go skiing anywhere Monday through Thursday, and there's plenty of room there. So we'd love to see people stay a little bit longer and fill in some of those gap periods. So, you know, pre-Christmas, we'd love to see people come a lot earlier than these crazy holiday periods.
Are there any innovations on the horizon that you're excited about? I mean, I learned to ski when I was in second grade. I didn't grow up here in Park City, but for whatever reason, it was my parents' thing. So like when I was in first or second grade is when I learned to ski. And nobody had snowmaking.
Sure.
So you'd plan a trip and you didn't know if you were going to be able to ski or not. So that was a big innovation that has taken place. And then I would argue the shape skis and snowboarding were two big innovations. Anything on the horizon that you see?
You know, I think they continually improve all those things, and those are all great ones. Lift technology, you know, it used to be really cool when you hopped on a high-speed lift. That was a real bonus. Now almost everybody's got all high-speed lifts, and when you hop on one that's not, you feel like the lift's broken.
You know what's funny about the high speeds is I teach a handful of weekends at Deer Valley as a part-time instructor. And so they've shared the numbers. There's only one or two fixed grips over at Deer Valley, but they've done the numbers. It's only like 20 seconds that you save on the few remaining ones. But you hear guests say all the time, oh, I'm really surprised this is fixed grip.
Yeah.
It's just become an expectation, although Absolutely. It may not really be that big of a time saver.
And sometimes the resorts, depending on how many people they have on the hill, I know they don't run those high-speed lifts at their highest capacity either. They'll slow things down a little bit if there are, depending on how many people are on the mountain, depending on, you know, what part of that mountain that lift is on. In terms of innovation, I think snowmaking continues to improve. The quality of the snow, the efficiency of how you make that snow. So it costs less to make it. You use less water, less air, less energy. And certainly being able to make that snow at higher temperatures is really important.
Let's talk a little bit about the business of the ski industry and how it's changed. We had Vail with the Epic Pass, which kind of changed the dynamic of where you go and where you ski. Now we have Aspen and IntraWest combining forces. And here's a quote from a USA Today article that with the Aspen IntraWest combined pass that has the reach of all resorts belonging to Aspen and IntraWest, that will change the calculus of destination skiers. A New York family that was seeking a Park City Christmas vacation because it would dovetail well with a spring break trip to Vail might now also consider an Aspen Christmas trip, knowing it could use its pass to go to Steamboat. When you guys heard about that Aspen IntraWest combo, did it scare you a little bit?
You know, I wouldn't say it scared us. As we talked about earlier, our numbers are doing really well, and I think Utah is going to continue to do well. I think the real winner here is going to be the consumer, and that that competition is going to make things better for the consumer. You've now got two big companies in that space that have those incredible deals for season passes. I mean, a season pass at Stowe last year was $1,800, I think, and they're going to be they're going to have an opportunity to have an Epic Pass that is good at Stowe and at Park City and at Whistler and at Breckenridge and Vail and, you know, all the other skiers. So, no, I think it's certainly going to change things, and that remains to be seen. And it'll be a year or two before I think we hear from the Aspen guys exactly what that pass is going to look like.
And but are you guys reaching out? You mentioned Stowe. Are you guys now doing some marketing and more outreach in the New England area as a result of Vail's acquisition of Stowe?
Yeah, you know what? We're not blind to that fact for sure, and knowing that people, New York is our biggest market. So having destination market anyway, having those people be able to have a Stowe pass and know that it's good in Park City, we're paying attention to that for sure.
So let's talk about the business side of what Ski Utah does. This is big business for the state of Utah. And some of our audience, I suspect most of our audience knows, but some may not. Your job is to promote the state of Utah to get more skiers in. You mentioned New York is your biggest market for bringing in destination skiers. First, share with our audience what it means from a total dollars to the state of Utah as well as tax revenue, the ski industry.
Sure. So some of the numbers we shared at our press conference this year, we bumped up our economic impact from, we do surveys every other year. So 2 years ago, the economic impact for skiing was $1.17 billion. That was in the 14-15 ski season. And this year it was all the way up to $1.43 billion. There's an increase there, not only from the volume of skiers that came our way, but the numbers that we see in per skier spending was up as well. And that jumped from $276 2 years ago to $296 per skier this year.
Is that per skier per day?
Per skier per day.
Those are really impressive numbers. And you take probably about 8% of that, and that's what it means to the state of Utah in income tax. Is that correct?
Yeah. And so we don't have a local state and local tax number, but for instance, tourism as a whole in the state of Utah is about an $8 billion income, and state and local taxes there is $1.15 billion. In state and local taxes.
So it's really important work that you guys are doing. And I'm sure you've looked at the numbers. Give us an idea of the size of the budget for Ski Utah, and then is it like a 4 or 5x return for every dollar we spend promoting, the state gets back 4 or 5?
You know, we've got a relatively small budget. It's around $3 million, but we work closely with the state of Utah and their Office of Tourism. They're spending more than our entire budget on purely on a media buy, just and that's just a media buy just for skiing. So, that allows us to spend our dollars a little bit differently on different programs where they're spending it just buying media. And we've worked really, really hard to get the Office of Tourism funded to a significant level. They're now at $21 million. When I started, I don't know how long it is ago now, 15 years ago, their budget was less than $1 million to market this stage.
And, you know, a lot of things have been getting squeezed on budget, right? We're trying to do more with less. Obviously, it's every business. The government's goal as well is to get results for fewer dollars. I think the reason we're seeing that is just the state realizes it's a good investment.
Oh, absolutely. It's now, tourism is now the state's largest export and surpassed the extractive industries. It's and it's only going up. So we're just really lucky to be in a state where we've got this incredible, very diversified tourism economy. So you've got skiing all winter, and you've got 5 national parks, and endless opportunities with things to do.
Well, then that begs the question about the unflattering publicity Utah has gotten as a result of the 0.05 BAC law.
Yep.
And you indicated in the conference last week that you have been talking to the governor's office, the speaker's office, the president of the Senate about what tweaks can we make to this bill? How can we achieve the public safety goal that is behind the bill and still tell our visitors that they're welcome here and they can have a drink if they want one?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be really clear, the goal is public safety, I think, and that's not something that we disagree with in any manner. But the idea, we continually battle this perception of Utah being a place that you can't have any fun. And when we look at data that compares us to our competition, Colorado, Arizona, California, on a overall state tourism level, we get low marks in a relative to those other states in the having fun and nightlife category. And we just want to work with our legislators to make sure that we don't increase that, that number, that perception. So we're working really hard with those guys to come up with a plan. And Colorado has a graded system where a 0.05, between 0.05 and 0.08 is a different penalty than 0.8 and beyond. And it's hard to imagine. It just doesn't make sense to penalize somebody who blows a 0.05 at the same level as somebody who blows a 0.15.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. We've got to wrap up, Nathan, but I want to ask you, here we're in Park City. We're very familiar with the two resorts in our backyard. I want to give you a chance to maybe tell us a story about a lesser-known resort, maybe, and the positive impact that Ski Utah has had on their local economy.
That's a tough question, but
is it like asking you to pick a favorite child or something?
It is a little bit. I'll tell you one of my favorite local resorts. Smaller resort of late is Brianhead, and we've worked really closely with, they've got new ownership, a gentleman named John Grissinger, who bought Brianhead sight unseen. He worked in the chemical business in Kansas City, and he has come out to Brianhead and so dramatically changed the culture at that place with this positive attitude he has. And people love working there now, and I like to think that we've helped them a bunch with their marketing opportunities. And we've got all these cool little spots that of course we have Park City and Deer Valley right out the back door that is such incredible skiing, and we've got 14 awesome resorts and fun to mix it up a little bit.
Speaking of Brianhead, have you had any contact with anyone there about the wildfire that they've evacuated that town?
Yeah, we have. And I know they primed all their snowmaking pumps and were really worried about what was going on there. So we've been keeping close tabs on that fire and reaching out to those guys, see if there's anything we can do to help.
Well, we wish them well. And it was a great story that you shared. I did not know that about Brianhead, and that's why I asked it. There's all these little towns here in Utah that have ski resorts, and it's a great industry. It provides a great lifestyle for those of us that choose to live in those towns. Our guest this morning has been Nathan Rafferty. He's the CEO and president of Ski Utah. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hello, I'm Justin Keyes. As an attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo, I'm pleased to support Mountain Money on KPCW. Our firm provides construction, real estate, and general business legal services to the Park City community. We are online at joneswaldo.com and can be reached at 435-200-0085.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Great conversation. Wow, what a fun way to start the second era of Mountain Money with my new co-host, Renee Bodley. I know, as I mentioned earlier, I know Larry worked very hard over several years, as did Bob Hendricks, to line up getting Ty Burrell to come in. So thank you to Larry and Bob. Thanks for making that happen.
Is every Monday this fun on Mountain Money? Guests have been fabulous.
Bob, we're going to raise the bar. Bob's our producer and lines up the guests. We're going to raise the bar. It just goes up from here.
Well, we also want to give our listeners some information they can use when it comes to their finances. And Doug, what do you got on your plate there?
Yeah, so, you know, it's one of the things Larry and I had talked about doing is talking a little bit more about the finances and the decision making that impacts the majority of our listeners. This is a business show. It's also a show about investing. And so there's been a couple relevant, really interesting things that happened in the last week. One is the Fed Open Market Committee met this last week. They're the ones that set interest rates. Everybody was expecting interest rates to go up. They did, which I would argue it went up by a quarter basis point. I would argue that's good news for all of us. They only did that because they thought the economy is strong enough and can handle that. But the thing I thought would be interesting to talk about is, you know, what does it mean when interest rates go up? What does that mean to all of us that have mortgages? We have car loans, our kids have student loans. And how to make good decisions on debt. And I guess there's two things I wanted to share. One is you can only control what you can control. You know, the Fed has signaled that they're likely going to raise rates one more time this year. You know, if you're doing a mortgage right now, you know, one of the biggest decisions you have is should you have a fixed rate mortgage or should you have a floating rate mortgage? And you can't control the outcome. I mean, in 10 years, it'll be clear whether you would have been better with one or the other. The thing I would say, though, is if you can afford the mortgage on a fixed rate mortgage, I would have a really strong bias towards going with a fixed rate because you know you can pay that. The temptation is a floating rate note. Mortgage can be less expensive early on. But, you know, the world has a way of changing in ways that's really hard for us to predict. And I don't think interest rates are going to rise dramatically over the next 5 or 7 years. There's a lot of forces that will likely keep them down. But if you can afford the fixed rate mortgage, I counsel my clients to think really hard about doing that.
And a fixed rate, 30-year fixed rate mortgage right now, are we still in the fours?
Yeah, probably around the fours right now. You know, when I moved to Park City 11 years ago, my mortgage was 6.5%. I could have saved a lot of money by doing a floating rate. But following my own advice, which frankly, sometimes people in our industry have a hard time. It's one thing to give somebody else advice. It's another thing to do it yourself. I went with a fixed rate because I knew I could refinance as rates went down. And you can. One of the things most people don't know is you can do a zero cost refinance. Like right now, interest rates are about 4. If you're willing to accept a slightly higher rate, and we don't do mortgages, I use a third party mortgage broker just like everybody else does. But if you're willing to accept a slightly higher interest rate, that loan is more valuable if it's going to pay a higher interest rate over time, and you get what's called the yield spread premium. You can use that yield spread premium to pay all the costs of your loan. So I refinanced from 6.5% down to 2.5% fixed over a 3 or 4 year period, and none of those refinances cost me anything because I always accepted a slightly higher interest rate to pay all the closing costs.
We just heard on the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher this morning, Carol Agle was on doing a real estate report, and there was some concern that a hike in interest rates might get people shying away maybe from going into the real estate market. But there was an interesting point they made about most of the buyers
60-70% of the buyers here are cash buyers. So the interest rate may not, an increase in the interest rate may not have that negative effect on our real estate market like it may have on others. I thought that was fascinating.
I do too. I've heard that before. We've occasionally had mortgage brokers on as our guests or real estate people. They've shared that stat. I actually think that's the good news, bad news for a town like Park City. The reality is the homes here are expensive and credit is still pretty tight. And I think the reason we're seeing that is it's harder to get a loan for a higher end house. That's more expensive. So I think the people that are able to actually close on the deals are the ones that are able to pay cash. I think it would be healthier for our economy if that got more to a normalized rate where it's not half the people paying cash for a house.
Where should people look at putting their money right now? I'm hearing international markets might be pretty good.
Yeah, you know, it just like I said with the decision on floating rate or fixed rate, you'll look back in 10 years and it'll be crystal clear. What I think is important is come up with a game plan that you can stick with over time and really try really, really hard to stick with that. And most people are better served by being diversified. You're never going to have the best performing portfolio, but hopefully you never have the portfolio that scares you in such a way that you get out at the wrong time. I mean, some people did in 2008, 2009 get out at the wrong time. One other thing I just want to quickly mention, big news in the market and has some relevancy here in Park City, is Amazon, of all people, bought Whole Foods Market. And we have a very big Whole Foods Market about to open here. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out locally for us.
Yeah, that's interesting. Are you hearing any questions from your clients about the Trump administration? Are they worried? I mean, everyone's 401k is doing pretty well so far this year.
Yeah, no, it's a very active topic, the Trump administration. And, you know, our clients are on both sides of the political spectrum. But I never think it's a good thing when there's so much turmoil and uncertainty in the White House. The market doesn't like uncertainty. They do like the possibility of repatriating dollars that are being held overseas. That would be a stimulus for the country. They do like infrastructure spending. There's the Trump plan, if he's able to introduce it, is a very stimulative plan. I don't know, personally, I don't know how we as a country afford it. But with all the uncertainty going on right now in Washington, D.C., it seems unlikely that many of those things are going to go forward. Well, we should also take a moment and thank our great sponsors for Mountain Money. We couldn't do a show like this without our sponsors. They include Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Express, Park City Mountain and Apex Residences, and Viridian Park City, Columbus Pacific Properties.
Also want to thank Bob Hendricks, the wise man behind the board here, who's our producer. Thanks for setting up such a great show today, Bob, and making it easy for me for my first Mountain Money. And thank you to you, Doug, for making it easy for me, too. I really appreciate it.
We chatted briefly about this last time, but as Larry was retiring, I was hoping you'd be willing to come in. I think it's nice to have the general manager as our co-host. And I know your plate is very full with all the new job responsibilities, so I'm glad you have time to join us.
Well, thank you very much. And for all our listeners out there, one last check on the weather. Sunny, clear today, high near 84. Tonight, low around 52. It's going to be a warm, sunny week all week. That does it for this Mountain Money segment. I'm Renee Bodley with my co-host, Doug Wells. Have a fabulous Monday, June 19th, and we will talk to you next week.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
You're listening to KPCW Park City.